Welcome to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries from Skywatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I am Sharon Gilbert, and we are in our library set, of course, and you've, I hope, got your tea or coffee at home, because we're continuing our discussion with L.A. Marzulli about megalithic sites and supernatural worldviews and so many things that I think help us to understand the Bible in its proper context.
Absolutely. One of the things I really respect about L.A., and he's caught a lot of criticism from skeptics and even from other, well, the other Christians, yeah, who thinks that he's going after the sensational, the fantastic.
Woo-woo.
But I give him a lot of credit. And one of the reasons we love him is because he is willing to take risks. He's willing to go out there and risk his reputation, but also his personal resources,
yes,
to go and research and find this information regarding the existence of the giants that we read about in the Bible, and try to find explanations for some of these more mysterious things around the world, megalithic structures and knowledge that appears to have been lost at some point in history. How did they build without mortar at places like Sacsayhuaman and in the Peruvian megalithic structures? LA's out there actually researching it, trying to get those answers on site.
He is. Well, we're going to dig right into our bag.
Oh, this week's assignment.
This week's assignment. So I'm not really sure what's in here. I haven't looked ahead, but here you go.
Ah, the confidential folder.
I know.
And again, you can ask questions. Send your questions to us, topics you would like researched or addressed, bgm@skywatchtv.com. And we'll do our best to dig into those for you.
We will. And after the break today, we are going to tell you about our trip to Turkey. I hope it's this year, 2022.
Speaking of Turkey.
Oh.
How coincidental.
There are no coincidences. There are not. Well, this was back in October of last year, but it's still an amazing, in fact, we may even get to go there.
Well, yes, this was a site that we put on our wish list for the tour of Turkey.
We had a long wish list,
yeah,
but they're trying their best to get it fulfilled.
A site called Karahan Tepe.
Tepe just means hill or mountain.
Right, yeah, like Göbekli Tepe sounds very exotic, but actually it just means potbelly hill.
Yeah.
Karahan Tepe, similar. Göbekli Tepe is interesting enough because it had developed the reputation of being the world's oldest temple. And our good friend, Dr. Judd Burton and Dr. Aaron Judkins have written about the influence of the Watchers, the angelic sons of God, on Göbekli Tepe. But Karahan Tepe, and Göbekli Tepe dated to about 10,500 BC, but there are scholars now who believe that Karahan Tepe may be even older.
Oh, exactly. And it's in that whole province of Sanliurfa, and that's a region that I think we are going to.
Sanliurfa is believed to be one of the potential sites of Ur of the Chaldees.
Yes.
Where Abraham came from. It was very close to ancient Haran.
Chaldees as the Chaldeans. That's a different group of people.
Anachronistic, yes.
Yeah. We won't go there, but Chaldees. By the way, archaeologists who are digging at Karahan Tepe believe that the human depictions of stone heads might be the oldest.
Right, even older than the ones at Göbekli Tepe.
Yes.
One of the interesting similarities, though, is like at Göbekli Tepe, they've got these T-shaped figurines that represent human figures, but they've also got some different figures that they characters that are not present at Göbekli Tepe, like humans carrying leopards on their back. And I like the way the artist or the author of the piece put it, suggests that there may have been different relationships between humans and animals back in the day. I'm sorry, even 11,000, 10,000 years ago, you're not going to walk around with a leopard on your back.
You're
that's just
really
not going to happen.
Not. Sorry, but that's not going
to
happen.
There's a religious aspect to that.
There is. And one of the stories that I follow all the time, daily news, is to see what Turkey is, what the big stories out of Turkish news are. And oftentimes, they are archaeological in nature. I believe Turkey wants very badly to bring Western visitors to these sites. And they are putting in huge welcome centers at many of them, which will have a lot of comfortable places to sit, places where you can go to the bathroom if you need to, but also buy some iced coffee, things like ice cream, who knows, but also get the information. And when you're on these tours, having a place that's comfortable where you can all get together and discuss what you're seeing, it's kind of hard to find.
Yeah, but the Turkish government obviously very interested in promoting tourism and a new reputation. It wants to develop a reputation as being the actual cradle of civilization.
Yes, and after we actually go back to L.A. Marzulli and his wonderful information, you and I are going to talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. L.A. Marzulli, we asked him about why these sons of God, these angelic beings, referred to in Hebrew texts as watchers, why they decided to interact with humans in the first place. Mm-hmm. And he talks about that when the Bible's Greatest Mysteries continues.
With the official disclosure of UFOs moving full steam ahead, very few will be prepared for what is coming. The answers are now available in Josh Peck's groundbreaking new Skywatch Films documentary DVD, over 10 years in the making, entitled The Great Delusion, The Second Coming of Earth's Oldest Enemy, along with Dr. Thomas Horn's documentary-style expose on DVD, Rome and the Star God, and the late Chris Putnam's Vatican presentation on DVD, Astrobiology and the Vatican ET Connection. Josh Peck's new documentary, The Great Delusion, reveals for the first time why the Vatican is in possession of a telescope named the Lucifer Device, why the ancient and mysterious Anasazi suddenly disappeared from the historic record, how alien abductions might be connected to the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis, whether there is a secret alien-human hybridization program being conducted on Earth right now, if there is a connection between aliens and supernatural entities such as demons and fallen angels, and what we can do to prepare for what's ahead. You'll also see stunning reports on the UFO phenomenon by Dr. Thomas Horn, Josh Peck, L.A. Marzulli, Timothy Alberino, Nick Pope, Chris Putnam, Chuck Misler, and many more. You'll also receive Dr. Thomas Horn's documentary-style expose, Rome and the Star God, on DVD. Join Dr. Horn for this incredible expose on how the Vatican is not only willing to accept our alien brothers with open arms, but are actually enabling the arrival of the end-time star god, the Antichrist. But that's not all. We're also including the late Chris Putnam's shocking presentation entitled Astrobiology and the Vatican ET Connection on DVD, detailing the Vatican's plans to baptize aliens upon their arrival and how contemporary societies will soon look to the aliens to be the saviors of humankind. Sold separately, these items have a retail value of $75. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling while supplies last. Prepare for full disclosure with The Great Delusion special offer. Available now at SkywatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
The Bible's Greatest Mysteries is part of Skywatch TV. Follow us online at skywatchtv.com.
We talked a little bit about the angels and the word angel and the fact that it's really an imprecise term. When Timothy Alberino was here previously, we talked about his book Birthright, and he refers to the denizens of the spirit realm as our elder brothers. That in the parable of the prodigal son, we are the younger son. The angels, if you will, are the elder brother. But as you know, not all of them have opted to be like the elder brother in that parable, faithful to the Father. He's created us all with free will, and many of them have chosen to rebel. Why is the term angel imprecise? And I guess as a follow-up to that, why would some of them choose to, as Jude put it, abandon their proper abode or their first estate to come down here to Earth?
Let me answer the latter part of the question first. We get this in Genesis 3:15, which is unfortunately overlooked by most of the church. And in that scene, you've got the pre-incarnate Christ, in my opinion. You've got Adam and Eve over here, and you've got the serpent, you've got the dragon. What comes down, in my opinion, sets up the rest of the biblical prophetic narrative. Because Jesus tells them, looks at the dragon and says, Your offspring will be at enmity, at war with the offspring and seed of the woman. One coming from the woman, he will crush your head, you will bruise his heel. Well, the dragon's not stupid and knows that, you know, whatever he's saying is going to happen. He knows that. That's the end game. So the dragon only has one choice. Somehow he has to use his seed to wipe out the seed of the woman three chapters later in Genesis 6. And it's not taught in most seminaries. And people, I mean, for the last 30 years, I've been fighting upstream on this and continue to do so now. But more and more people are coming over to sort of our side and looking at the Nephilim, realizing it's not some mighty man. This is the progeny of the fallen angelic host and the women of Earth, creating a hybrid being, which was never supposed to be on the planet, known as the Nephilim. So they do this, and this is in my book, Countermove, which is the latest book that just came out this year, How the Nephilim Returned After the Flood. And I'll just tell you the story. I was reading a book which was talking about the fact that the Nephilim returned after the flood because one of Ham's wife had the Nephilim gene,
right,
which is total speculation, and it's interesting. I mean, I'll give it that. Mm-hmm. But I never bought into that because that makes God some sort of like, I'm going to wipe out the entire planet, but what? I'll allow Ham's wife to come on knowing that she's got the Nephilim gene in her, and that's going to start all the mischief again. And then on the other hand, you would go, well, where's Noah in all this? I mean, Noah's going to not know that Ham's wife is contaminated on some level. I'm not buying it. So I went to bed that night, and I was kind of depressed because, you know, Lord, how am I going to, you know, do this? And the Holy Spirit begins to speak to me, and I realize I can get and sound a little woo-woo, but not in an audible voice. But he just basically said, what happened at the end of World War II? And I said, what? I have no idea what you're talking about. A little pause, and then he says, what did the Japanese do at the end of World War II? And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, I'm really not sure. He said, kamikaze pilots. And then the light bulb went off. I said, okay. They were desperate. They knew that the war was lost. These people, because they had no other choice, they decided to sacrifice their lives in hope of turning the tide of the Allies, turning the tide of the war, suicide mission. It failed, but that's what they did. Then he goes, go back to the book of Enoch. And I know exactly what chapter he was pointing to. And Semyaza, the head angel, the head entity, very powerful entity, says to the other 200 watcher angels, so it's a class of angels, watcher angels, I fear that you will not agree to do this thing, and I alone shall have to bear the penalty of a great sin. And the light bulb went off. I jump out of bed. This is like 10 o'clock our time. I run down. I start telling Peggy. Then I run in the other room. I get the phone. I call Gary Sturman up. It's midnight, his time. He's up. We talked for like an hour on the phone about this. And that became the book. The warfare for that book, Derek, was unlike anything I've ever experienced. It took 2 years to write. And it should have taken 6 months. 2 years, I was pulling and pushing. And the warfare was off the hook. Bottom line is, it's a suicide mission of the fallen angels. They know what they're going to do, but they've been promised that there's going to be a jailbreak. They've been promised that they're going to get out. And they do it again and again and again and again, because that's the only option that they have until the cross and it all goes away. This is why when Jesus descends to the lower parts of Earth's Tartarus, right, and it's a proclamation, according to Bullinger, that E.W. Bullinger, that no jailbreak, I got the keys right here, game over. So this is why they come here. This is why they were here, to try to stop that prophecy from Genesis 3:15 from ever being fulfilled. And you know what? They got really close, because only 8 people in the flood. After that, not so much. But it continues until really the conquest of Canaan. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, to all the folks that don't believe in the Nephilim, then the God of the Old Testament is pretty bloodthirsty, capricious, maniacal, favoring one tribe of people over another, you know, vengeful, murderous. I mean, you know, bloodthirsty. Because he tells Joshua and Caleb, wipe them all out. Wipe all the tribes of men, women, children, all the animals, burn everything. What are we looking at here? What we're looking at is everything is completely contaminated because of the presence of these fallen entities, these illegal intruders into our genome. And that's why the mandate comes down like that. Once we get that, I remember when I was a new Christian 41 years ago, reading the Old Testament for the first time and almost throwing the Bible against the wall, I go, Jesus, I get, I love Jesus, I get it. The God of the Old Testament, got to be two different people here. Maybe there's two different gods. Maybe they got it wrong. And then I read Dr. I.D. Thomas's book about 10 years later, opened up everything, and that's where we are building on his work, and that's why we're on the trail of the Nephilim.
Hmm. The Nephilim, then, the product of this these illicit unions between these entities that are identified in the Book of Enoch as watchers.
We only see watchers, right.
The watchers mentioned in Daniel chapter 4, correct, where they're mentioned in the context of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, his disturbing dream, where Daniel has to tell him the right. dream first and then the interpretation.
And there's good watchers and bad watchers. It's a right. rank. It seems to be a type.
Well, yeah. In Daniel 4, there's a mention that the punishment of Nebuchadnezzar, where he was destined to for 7 years of madness, right. was decreed by the watchers. So right. that sort of implies they've got some kind of authority in the over God's creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But not all of them obviously have chosen to follow his will.
And this is, you know, this is the $64,000 question that keeps me up at night sometimes. And I wonder why the rebellion. And this is why I don't believe in, like, and I, no offense to those of you who are completely on Earth, but I think that the, you know, this whole thing, this whole construct goes back millions of years, because you just don't create the angelic host on day whatever, and then 24 hours later they rebel. You know, I'm not sure why we're rebelling, but doggone it, we're going to do it. I mean, it makes no sense. I think the seeds of the rebellion go back to the Shining One, to Lucifer, the light bearer, and he's jockeying and he's sowing the seeds of doubt and promising this and promising that. And I also think, and I got there on my own, he wants to be worshipped. There's no doubt about that. Absolutely no doubt about that. And I know that even as a Christian, coming across the line and going into a church setting and not understanding what's this worship stuff all about? Why do I have to do this? Human beings don't really want to worship anything, you know, if it comes...
Except ourselves.
well said. But it's true. I mean, it's absolutely true. And now it's like, you know, we those of us who are born again and spirit-filled, we realize the sacrifice of Jesus, what he did for us, and we worship freely. We worship in spirit and in truth. We worship him. We realize he's our creator. And I love that. Love that scripture that he is before all things, and he holds all things together. He holds you and me and everyone watching together. And that's, I don't understand any of this. I mean, I'm like a kid in a toy shop. I'm kind of just, you know, I'm about 4 or 5 years old, realizing that, wow, something's going on here. But on this side of the veil, we see through the dark, mm-hmm. the glass darkly, dimly. And I know that eventually when we're translated, which is going to be just amazing,
yeah.
right? We're going to see, and we're just going to be walking around with our jaws on the ground.
Well, that's really what it's all about, as Sharon and I found in our research for veneration, that this is really all about who gets resurrected at the end.
Right.
And it's either the children of Adam and Eve that God created to give dominion to the earth, or the children of the watchers who they created to take dominion away from us. You referenced 1 Peter 3, verses 18 through 20, where he descend to proclaim to the spirits right.
in prison.
And often that was taught by Bible teachers, that Jesus is proclaiming to the human dead or preaching to them.
Yeah.
But this word translated spirit, the spirits in that verse, never in the New Testament refers to human spirits without qualification, specifically identifying them as human
uh-huh.
spirits.
Uh-huh.
So the implication there is he's talking to those very rebels, Shemiyazah and the other watchers. What do you think Jesus had to say when he went down there?
I think it was a proclamation. I think he just said, basically, no jailbreak. You're not getting out. I know what you were promised, but this is it. You're bound and fettered until the end, and that's it. And I think he dangled the keys, you know, figuratively, whatever. They didn't expect to see him down there. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about that. And then, of course, he leaves captivity captive, and he frees everybody, that the souls of humans. So, you know, they're still down there. And again, they were promised by, HaSatan himself, Lucifer, the dragon, many names. If you just do this, we're going to win. We'll wipe them out. We'll inherit the earth. It's all good.
Do you think he maybe lied to them the way he lies to us?
No. The father of lies. Are you kidding me? Of course he did. But that's the only shot that they have. The only shot they have is to somehow stop the Messiah from being born. And this is why, when he finally incarnates, the dragon, once he gets wind, I mean, think about this. Once the dragon gets wind of where the Messiah is going to come from, what lineage he's going to have, it's like just the attack is on. Look what Pharaoh does. I mean, you kill all the male babies. Why does Pharaoh wake up on a Monday morning and decide we're going to kill all the male babies of the Israelites? I'm not sure why we're doing that, but that's what we're going to do. So, you know, the dragon is with, and you remember, when Pharaoh was there, and most people don't understand this, but in ancient Egypt, there's a full occult religion that's the paradigm operating completely to the nines. I mean, this thing, that's why when Moses walks in and throws the serpent, you know, staff down, becomes a serpent, no one's going running out of the room going, oh my God, did you see that? No. Pharaoh's magicians do the same thing, and they're able to duplicate the first three plagues. It just shows you how deep they were in the kingdom of the dragon. They were there. So, I mean, this is, it's all very complex. It's all in our Bibles. And the deeper I go, the more amazed I am. And then also at just how much I don't know. I'm getting this much of the puzzle, and the picture's like a lot larger than that.
Hmm. The supernatural realm. You've coined the phrase, the guidebook to the supernatural. You should trademark that, because I would really love to steal that. But I actually know people who've been saved.
I know that, right.
Because of that. Because praise they thought the they were getting some secret insight into the... why is it the modern church is so blind to the fact that we're actually in the middle of a supernatural war?
I think it's Jesus' prophecy coming to light, that in the latter days, you know, in the end times, I'm paraphrasing here, they will have a form of religion but deny its power. Well, I mean, that's where we are, unfortunately. And I'm part of a church and I love the church. I'm not bagging on the church here. But the church needs reformation. I find myself reticent in even going because it's just the same format week after week after week after week. So, and especially the younger generation, you know, the millennials are looking at this going like, I'm not doing this anymore. They know Jesus, but they want the real thing. They want to see him move in power and in might. And unfortunately, the system that we have set up here doesn't allow anything to have happen. I mean, and you've got entire wings of the Christian church that don't believe in the Holy Spirit at all. All that died with the apostles, so you're just powerless here. Just shut up, and if you're good, somehow you'll get in. And another wing is exactly the opposite, you know, gold dust falling and gemstones and all this other stuff. So is there a middle ground? I think there is. I don't think the Lord does power tricks. And every time he's manifested, I used to be a worship leader for 25 years. And the last time I was at this place, Malibu Vineyard, I was the music director and worship leader there. I remember one night leading worship and no gimmicks, no nonsense, no smoke machines. They're just leading worship. And we got into the presence. I mean, we were there. And we just, it was like the Holy Spirit was all over us. And we just kept playing. Some of the team just dropped to their knees and it rolled off the stage. What I mean by that, his presence rolled off the stage and started touching people. People were healed. People were on their faces weeping in front of the Lord. So it's exactly the opposite, when, in my opinion, and people, and I get that. People go, well, that's just your experience, LA. But when he really shows up in a place, when the Spirit of a living God really shows up, it's not all this, you know, Yahoo nonsense. It's this holy moment, and people are convicted of their sin. A lot of crying. A lot of, you know, head on the floor, bowing before the presence of a living God because he's there. And people are getting healed and touched and delivered all at the same time all that worship is going on. So that's what we need in the church. That's what we need in the church. And then on top of that, you know, all this supernatural stuff is always pushed to the side, like the Genesis narrative, Genesis 3:15, like the presence of the Nephilim. And if you don't understand Genesis 3:15, when you get to the Tower of Babel, when you get to the five kings with Abraham and the crew, when you get to Sodom and Gomorrah, when you finally get to the conquest of Canaan, you have no idea what's going on, in my opinion.
That was really a suicide mission to corrupt humanity, knowing that they'd already been condemned for doing so, and yet coming to earth to take us with them in their destruction?
Exactly. You know, in my series, The Red Wing Saga, when I was doing research for the fallen realm and trying to find more information about the various players in history during the opening book deals with the Jack the Ripper, but that's not really the core story. It's something else. I discovered that one of the gentlemen who was in charge of investigating the Ripper murders was Sir Charles Warren, and he actually discovered a stone on Mount Hermon that reflects that oath that they all took. Shemyaza says, look, I'm not taking the fall for this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a suicide mission, but we're all going to do it, right? So you swear allegiance to me and that you won't rat on me to the one, to God Almighty. And it's in this stone. That memory mm-hmm. was still there when probably Alexander and his men went through, because it's in Proto-Greek.
Right, exactly. Thousands of years after this event took place, that site was still venerated as the place where the rebellion of the angels, the watchers, took place.
Yes, and veneration gets to the heart of it. In fact, you and I have written a book about that, and I think finding things like we've found at these sites in Turkey, this is giving us a glimpse into that pre-flood era and the post-flood era, which is a fascinating study, and I know that archaeologists are loving it. But you've got a brand new book out, so we'll need to talk about that next week.
Right.
Because don't really have time right now, but it is a definitive book about the return of that very entity
who forced
them to swear an oath.
Mm-hmm. You can find out more about our tour of Israel, and we'll put up a page at the website, BiblesGreatestMysteries.tv, about our
tour
plans
to Turkey.
Right, because among the sites, the Churches of Revelation, of course, Göbekli Tepe would be one. We'd also go to the museum at Sanliurfa, where they've collected artifacts from Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe.
Yes, now we might also go to Istanbul, which has also some great museums. Couldn't think of the word, but we'll also visit the seven cities of the seven churches of the Book of Revelation.
Oh, yes. And very close to one of those cities was the site of ancient Hierapolis in western Turkey. That's where you find the Plutonion, which translated into English means the gates of hell.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's that Turkey trip is going to be, well, frankly, it's on my bucket list.
Mine too. But it's because it relates to this long spiritual conflict, this supernatural conflict that is detailed in the Bible. From cover to cover, it is a long record of this war for the future of humanity, really our eternal future. And that's
why. It is one of the greatest mysteries of all.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why we're here investigating the Bible's greatest mysteries.